I came across an internet site this week called MadBid. And the seeming potential of this internet site seemed amazing. It was offering flat screen TVs that retail for £800 that you could get them for £70. And I'm thinking, this is good. And I look a little bit more and I find, and you know my love of Apple products, they've got a £2,000 retail Apple bundle. And I'm thinking, this is awesome. I can get it for £196. So I'm thinking, how do I get it? What do I have to do? And as I'm kind of looking at it, the more I'm beginning to think, this is amazing, but what's the catch? How can I show this is the real thing? How can I show that this isn't some kind of con? I kind of want to know, before I do anything, is this the real deal? I want to know, has someone I know, a friend, done it? You know, have they given their money, received the product? Have they won the bid at that ridiculously low price and actually benefited? I just want to know. I want to know someone who's done that before I then do it. I want to, as it were, a worked example before I commit my money or energy any further to an aside that on the face of it looks so good. And there are times, aren't there, when it seems that the gospel is too good to be true. You know, forgiveness of sins, right relationships with God, an eternal future where there is no suffering and no pain and no death, and it just kind of sounds too good to be true. And of course, if it's true, who wouldn't want those things? But many have rejected Christianity because to them it just seems too fanciful, unrealistic. And there are days, aren't there, when we as believers begin to doubt, begin to wonder, you know, is it real? You know, will it be as good as we hoped? You know, will Jesus come again? Will there be the new Jerusalem? Will there be no pain and no suffering? Will it be that good? And in the messiness of life and just the difficulty and troubles of doing life, you know, broken relationships and hard conversations and business troubles, that hope can just begin to wobble, doesn't it? And at those times, I want to know, is it the real deal? How can I be certain? And 2 Samuel 5 is one of those passages that kind of helps to cement my hope. It's kind of a passage that helps me to know I can be certain. Because it's the worked example. You remember doing your maths exams and you couldn't just give the answer. You had to show your workings. And the good news for someone like me is that even if you showed your workings and got the wrong answer, you got some points. And that was a good thing. And here is God's worked example. He's, as it were, in 2 Samuel 5, going to confirm that what he does here in 2 Samuel 5, if he can do it here, he can do it there. If he can do it for David and the people then he can do it for us and our future hope. If it's worked out here, then it will work out there. And so 2 Samuel 5 is a collage. Yeah, remember doing those at school? You know, taking various pictures of something to kind of build one comprehensive picture, you know, loads of different beach pictures, and then you put it all together and you get this massive seaside scene. I was useless at that as well. But 2 Samuel 5 is operating in that same way. You know, there are different pictures to make one big comprehensive one. So there are a number of events, and they're not mentioned chronologically. They're just not in any, they're not in order in that sense. So for example, in verse 11, the king of Tyre's actions. We know he was king in the last 10 years of David's reign. And yet it's here as if it's right at the beginning. We have a collection of David's wives, and we know that some of them he married before he was king, and some of them much later in his life as king, you know, and we know, for example, Solomon was born much later. But they're all put together here, right at the beginning of David's reign, to kind of give us a comprehensive picture of what's happening, what God is doing. And if God can do it here, then he can do it there. If he can do it for David, he can do it for us. And so the first thing we see is, verses 6 to 16, the kingdom established. There it is. Have a look at verse 6. King and his men, that is David, marched to Jerusalem to attack the Jebusites who lived there. Jebusite says to David, "You will not get in here. Even the blind and the lame can ward you off. And the end of verse 6, they thought, David cannot get in here. And they thought, wrong. Because verse 7, nevertheless, David captured the fortress of Zion, the city of David. This city that was impregnable, this city that was a fortress, this city that for centuries had remained in the land of Israel, inhabited by Jebusites, because they could not get rid of them, this city is now captured. But nevertheless, and we learn verse 8, how David defeats them. He uses the water shaft. And the water shaft's an ingenious bit of architecture. And here are some slides. You can see, here's the city of David at the... pointy time. City of David up here, and you can see... oh, it's gone. Oh, I was so excited. Disappointment. There's a gospel image. So the city of David's up there, and the shaft of things down right down here outside of the city, and they, what do? Is they go up the tunnel and into the city. Here's a picture. I don't know the lady. She's no friend of mine, but I just saw a picture. You can see just how amazing. They went up through this water shaft. So I guess what happens is David's men, he probably sends in his kind of elite SAS kind of guys. Up the water shaft they go. They get into the city, open the gates. The guys go in. This city, you know, where the Jebusites have been taunting him, hey, the blind and the lame are going to keep you out. Well, no, no, David defeats them. They're destroyed. Blame and light, the blind and the lame couldn't keep him out. And David then taunts them with their same kind of taunts against them, calling them now the blind and the lame. And they'll be the ones who are his enemies who will never enter his palace, verse 8, or literally his house. In other words, they'll never be part of God's people. In other words, his enemies are completely removed. And with that happening, if we know our Bibles, we know something significant is happening here. I mean, firstly, it was politically astute. In Jerusalem was located in the land allocated to Benjamin, the tribe Saul came from. So immediately by David moving operations to Jerusalem rather than Hebron where he had been, you know, David is wooing the tribe of Benjamin. He's kind of wooing the whole northern tribes who have just pledged their allegiance to him. He's saying, yeah, I'm on your side. I'm putting my capital in your kind of land. So it's politically astute. But actually it's far more significant than that. David's fulfilling God's promises. Promises of Genesis 15 where God had promised to Abraham, the land of the Ites, if I can put it that way, the Canaanites and the Jebusites and the Amalekites and the Midianites. And what we have now is these last, the Jebusites have removed. The land is now completely theirs. The promise that God had given to Abraham is now totally fulfilled. The land is theirs. And David, in doing, is obeying the law of Deuteronomy 7, which God had demanded that they would get rid of all foreigners in the land, and David had done that. He'd done what Joshua had failed to do in Joshua 15, where he'd left the Jebusites in the city because they couldn't defeat them, but now David has. David is the king after God's own heart. The capture of Jerusalem signifies completion. It's the kingdom established. It's like that moment when you're buying a house and you sign it and you kind of exchange contracts. And at that point, the house is yours, isn't it? No longer do you have to fret whether it will become yours or not. And you don't have to worry whether the seller will pull out or your buyer will pull out. The fretting's over. The worry is put aside. And now you can begin to enjoy and look forward and get excited about your new house. That's what's happening here. Kingdom's established. Just as God had promised. And the people had hoped for and longed for, and there's no longer enemies in the land who might take it away from them. And they had a king who would protect and rule over them. See, verse 9, the king has taken up residence in the city. Symbolic, isn't it? He's ruling. And he's beginning to build it up, and it's becoming more powerful because God is with him. Things are as they are meant to be. And as we read this, there's meant to be a sense of, oh, we're safe. We're secure. The enemies have been driven out. We reside in a fortress. God is with us. The kingdom is established. Oh, Now remember, it's a worked example. And so what God does here points forward to when the true king enters Jerusalem and establishes his kingdom. See, the kingdom is established here in 2 Samuel, but it's just partial, it's just a shadow, it's just a worked example. Thousands of years later, a descendant of David, King Jesus, would enter Jerusalem and he would do it on a donkey. And in Jerusalem, at that point, he wouldn't drive out the enemies as David had done, but he would be crucified. And his death and subsequent resurrection would bring about the inauguration of his kingdom, the real kingdom. And now through his death, people could enter that kingdom and they could come under King Jesus' rule and they could be his people. And by his death, he defeated their enemies. And so death and sin and Satan had been dealt with and there was forgiveness and eternal life as possible and were freed from serving Satan. And those who placed their trust in him could go, oh, we're safe. We're secure. But of course, it's only when Jesus comes again will the kingdom be fully established. See, for then, like David in 2 Samuel, Jerusalem will be established as Jesus' capital. Think of Revelation 21, the new Jerusalem comes down. And what does Jesus do? He takes up residence in it, just like David did. And Jesus will dwell with his people. And now our enemies will not just be defeated. What will happen? There'll be driven out. So there'll be no more pain or death or sickness and no more Satan. They're driven out. The kingdom is fully established. And the people are out to go, whew, we're safe, we're secure, nothing can harm us. The kingdom will be established. The promises are fulfilled just as the people long for and hope for. See, the picture here, it's just pointing forward to that greater hope, that greater reality. When the kingdom will be fully established. Where the king will dwell with his people. And all enemies will be driven out. And because we see it worked out here in 2 Samuel 5. Because we've seen the worked example. It gives us confidence of what we cannot see. See, if God can do it here, under David, defeat all the enemies of the land, even though they're in the strongest fortress, then God can do it there. If he can do it here, he can do it there. If God can establish his kingdom here, then he's going to establish his kingdom there. And we can know that with certainty. If he's going to do it for David, then he's certainly going to do it for Jesus. And of course, the cross just underlines and points and tells us with absolute certainty that's going to be the case. And so we're okay to keep on believing. We're okay to keep on hoping. To keep on trusting. The kingdom be established. And with the kingdom established, we begin to see its fruits. Verse 11, the king of Tyre sends messengers with gifts for David to build his palace. And of course, if we're thinking, we know our Bibles, we know that here again are God's purposes being fulfilled. Because the people of Israel were meant to draw in the Gentiles. And here is the Gentile king paying homage to the king of Israel. But of course, we also know it looks forward. Because what you see happening, Revelation 22, kings of the earth bring forth their glory to Jerusalem to pay their homage to King Jesus. And we're getting another glimpse of what King Jesus' kingdom is like. He's the one whom all kings will bow to. Not just the king of Tyre, but all kings will come and pay homage to King Jesus in his kingdom. And yet what's surprising is how David interprets it. See, verse 12, we're kind of expecting David to say the kind of things I've just mentioned, the king's coming in, fulfillment of promises, looking ahead, thinking of that day when Jesus comes. And David looks at it and he interprets the king of Tyre's actions as evidence that the Lord has established him as king. And has exalted his kingdom. And what comes next is even more of a surprise, because what we would expect him to say is that God had exalted David's kingdom for the sake of God's glory, his glory. But instead we read, end of verse 12, it's for the sake of his people, Israel. Not for God's glory, but for his people's. David is king for the sake of the people. David rules over Israel for Israel. The kingdom is exalted for the sake of the people. It's about the people, not the king. The king is to serve the people. The kingdom being exalted is for their sake, and it reveals God's love and his care for them and his desire to see his people succeed and be blessed and to be fruitful and established as it was supposed to be. And this kingdom will be exalted and all will know. And what's even more astonishing is when you look ahead. If this is the worked example and we look ahead, then Jesus is given as our king for our sake. And his kingdom is exalted in part for the sake of his people, us. See, Jesus is given as our king for our good. So John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. Jesus is given for the people, to save his people. He's come to serve the people. And Mark 10, verse 45, Jesus himself says, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve." We have a king who serves. We're given a king for our good. Now just ponder that. Think of every other major religion. They do not have leaders who came to serve. They have leaders who came to be served. But not Jesus. He came to serve. He came to die. He's a king for the sake of his people, for the good of his people, us. And he seeks to serve us and love us and protect us. That's a thought just worth pondering. We've been given a king for our good, for our sake, who came to serve us. And of course, if the king serves, if the king was a servant, well, then those today who lead God's people are to be servants as well. Servant leaders, serving others. Leading not for the sake of their own glory and pomp and status, but for the benefit of the people. So if we're leading groups or we're leading people, we need to be servant leaders. We need to be leading by serving and laying down our desires and our rights and seeking to put the best for others first. Because that's what Jesus did. He's a king for the sake of the people. We're to be leaders for the sake of the people, not for the sake of our own glory or ego. And of course, if our king is a servant who is given for the sake of the people, then his people are called to be servants for the sake of the people. We're called to serve. And we sometimes miss this. I often hear, recently at the moment, a number of times, a spiritual truth that is misapplied. So it goes something like this. People say, you keep talking about service and about serving. But the gospel is not about what I do. It's about trusting in Jesus. Now, of course, that is right. We're saved by faith alone in Jesus. Faith alone in his death and resurrection. Amen. And if I was in a black American church, you would be amening me back right now. But we are British and we're middle class and we just blank. But of course we believe that. We know no good works or acts of service can ever save us. But here's where we often misapply. Because we then think that means we don't have to serve because it's all of grace. But if I've truly grasped the gospel and seen that I've been saved by faith alone, saved by a king who has come to serve, who is given for my good, and in given for my good, he's come to serve me by dying, then surely my response can only be to follow his example and serve. And I want to say, if I'm not serving in some manner, and I recognize there may be reasons and there may be difficulties and there may be seasons, limited or extended, where it's not possible to serve as you would want to serve. But if I'm not serving in some manner, I want to say I've not grasped the gospel. Because the gospel is of a king who serves by dying for us. And if the king is a servant, then surely I'm called to serve and follow. And Ephesians 2:10 says, we've been created in Christ Jesus to do good works, to serve. So will you follow your King, who served you by saving you? Will you serve? Are you serving? You see, not only do we discover that our King comes to serve, but we discover this kingdom is exalted, and not for him, although it is, and the scriptures tell us over and over that Jesus will be glorified. You know, John 17, Philippians 2, Revelation 22. Jesus is exalted. Jesus is glorified. Ephesians 1, he is head over all things. God has given him the glory. But we also see here that his kingdom is exalted for the sake of his people, us. And in that, as the kingdom is exalted, and I take it ultimately on that last day, there is the same sense it was for the Israelites, that it reveals God's love and his care for us, his desire to see his people succeed and be blessed and to be fruitful and established as it was supposed to be. But I think also the exaltation of the kingdom is before the world for our sake, because it demonstrates that we were right. Not in a boasting sense, but in an affirming manner. You know, as those who had to endure the taunts of the other kingdoms, as those who had to endure the mocking of other religions, as those who have been scorned and betrayed and persecuted, as those who have sought to serve this kingdom, given away our money and our time and our energy, and the world looking on us and thinking we were foolish, and at points sacrificing our lives, even to the point of death. Think of all those heroes of the faith who have flown to other lands and landed, Jim Elliot lands, and to go and speak to a people and see them saved, and they kill him within days of him arriving, giving their lives. And the world looks at that and says, that's just foolish. Why would you do that? And as the kingdom is exalted, there's a sense of vindication for God's people. There's a sense of Jesus proclaiming to the watching world on that last day, they were not foolish. They did not sacrifice in vain. They did not give away their money and their time and their energy for nothing. They didn't serve with all they had as if it was foolish and pointless and futile. No, they did so for the one kingdom that is exalted. The one kingdom that is real and endures. The one kingdom, my kingdom, that will last forever. They, before the world, this kingdom is exalted, and all will see it wasn't in vain. We weren't foolish. Jesus is King. And his kingdom endures. And it's just another demonstration of his care and love for us as his kingdom is exalted. We have a king for our good. But sadly, not all is good in the establishing of the kingdom in 2 Samuel 5. Oh, there are blessings. David's physical house is being built, and his dynastic house is being built. He's having children like it's kind of going out of fashion. And in the context of such a positive chapter, we're meant to think of this. This is a blessing. This is a hint and sign that God is blessing David. But 13 to 16 are also a little hint that David is not quite the king they were all hoping for. See, just as Samuel prophesied in 1 Samuel 8, just as Saul was being anointed, as he's trying to warn Israel that the king will take your daughters to be his wives. And here King David is. And he's doing so in disobedience to the law, because Deuteronomy 17 very clearly says the king must not take many wives. But David disobeys. And right here we're going to get a hint of what will be his downfall. It's going to be his lust for women. And it will be that lust and thinking that he can marry whoever he wants and have whoever he wants that will result in adultery and murder and will begin to mark the decline of his kingdom. See, the kingdom's established. The promises are fulfilled. If God can do it here, he can do it there. But as we look at the here in 2 Samuel 5, we're left wanting a greater king. A king who will not disobey. A king who will be perfectly after God's own heart. And that's what we get in the there, isn't it? The here points to the there. The kingdom's established. If he can do it here, he will do it there. And then secondly, and finally, we see a kingdom protected. Verses 17 to 25, and it's not as long as the first point. They're not equally. So the kingdom's protected. See, the Philistines hear the news, and David is king, and the kingdom is united, and they do not like the news. So they went up, verse 17, in full force to search for David. And David hears of their movements, and he goes down to meet them. And verses 18 to 25 report Israel's two victories over the Philistine. And we're kind of meant to hold them together. Because what we're seeing is God's promise to David in chapter 3, verse 18. Just the page before, coming to pass. See, chapter 3, verse 18, David, the Lord had promised that by my servant David I will rescue my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies. The Lord, in other words, will protect his people. He will uphold them. And so these two episodes reveal how God protects his people. And firstly, he protects them by his guidance. So at the start of both episodes, David inquires of the Lord, verse 19, verse 23. And even though he faces pretty much identical situations, the Lord's guidance varies. So the first time he commands David to go up and that he'll certainly give the Philistines into their hand. The second time he cautions, verse 23, do not go straight up, circle around them and tap them in front of the balsam trees as soon as you hear the sound of marching. Now the text doesn't stress the diversity or why the diversity. What the text stresses is that it's the Lord who is guiding his people. It's the Lord who knows what is best in the situation. It's the Lord who will protect Israel. It's the Lord protecting his people in both accounts. And of course, we've got to keep thinking, if he can do it here, then he can do it there. If he can protect them, he can protect me. And we see how he's going to protect his kingdom, and it's by his power. And in the first account, we just see his outright power to defeat armies. David describes the victory not in terms of how he and his men fought the battle, but verse 20, have a look. The Lord broke out against my enemies. The Lord broke out like the waters break out. Have you ever seen those pictures of tidal waves just kind of sweeping in onto the land, breaking onto the land, just the force of water destroying, literally leveling everything in its wake, people and buildings? That's the picture here. The Lord just kind of breaks out against the Philistine. He levels that Philistine army. And as those who are able to flee, they do so leaving their idols. And it's the very idols which Saul's head had been paraded in front of all those years before. It's the very idols in whom the Philistines had boasted and sung about back in chapter 1. And here they were now, just lying in the sand, as the Lord has broken out against the Philistines. They're left abandoned in the wake of the Lord's power. And the picture, isn't it? Don't worry. Don't worry about your enemies. Don't worry about their gods, because the Lord's power is such, he can destroy them. And then we see his power in a slightly different light in the second episode. We see it as the mighty warrior who leads out his people, verse 24. And so when the Israelite army hear the rustling in the trees, that's the sign that the Lord has gone out in front to strike the Philistine army. And so verse 25, David did as the Lord said and struck down the Philistines. And now the kingdom's established and the kingdom is protected, not by the human king, although he's often the instrument, but ultimately the Lord, whose power defeats the Philistines and protects the kingdom and God's people who goes out before them. And the reality is we need to hold on to such a truth. It's the worked example, isn't it? If he can do it here, then he can do it there. If he can protect them there, he can protect you and me there. Dow Ralph Davis comments, contemporary Christians must not tone these texts down. for the text mean to impress us with the fact that we do not have a namby-pandy godlet, a stone statue that can be easily abandoned. No, God's people have a God who is a smasher and a fighter, a God mighty in battle. We have a God who can defend his sheep and restrain and conquer all his and our enemies. And so we don't need to fear Satan or death or sickness or sadness or poverty or enemies who oppose us or other religions or eternity. We do not need to fear because Jesus has conquered all that can possibly oppose us. And 2 Samuel 5 reminds us we have a God who is mighty in battle, who's a smasher and a fighter, who protects his people. And if our God can protect his kingdom under David, then his people today never need fear. Because this God is more than able to always lead us in triumph, is always able and willing to lead us home. See, there's no doubt that Jesus' kingdom will be fully established. The cross has already defeated all our enemies, and all that is to come is their sweeping up and removal. And we have one who can do that with ease. His kingdom will be established and it will be protected. If God can do it here, he can do it there. We just need to keep holding on and reminding ourselves of that truth. If he can do it here, he can do it there. Let's take a moment as the band come up before we sing our final song. Take a moment to reflect on what the Lord has been speaking. We're going to sing "We're Not Alone" for the guys. Are you confident in an established kingdom? Are you confident that God can protect? Are there areas where you need to change? Do you need to start serving? Are you looking forward to that day when the kingdom is exalted? Do you need to keep hearing that promise? It won't be in vain. It won't be futile. If he can do it here, he can do it there.